Today is September 11th, 2019. I watched the videos recorded on that eventful day of 9/11 back in 2001. It still brings tears, of course. All people need to remember that day was that we need to be vigilant and aware of those who wish to harm us. For 102 minutes that eventful day, September 11th, 2001 changed America. We'll never forget that day. Sadly, 3,000 lives were lost. We will always be thankful of the many firemen and policemen who unselfishly went into the buildings to save many lives. May the 343 who heroically lost their lives to save others always be remembered. 18 years later, people have become complacent. September 11th should never, ever be an ordinary day. We need to be reminded of this horrific day.
I, and all of us here, offer our continuing prayers to those who suffered as a result of the 9/11 attacks. And I offer this friendly advice to any enemy who would dare do such a thing again. Don't you dare. America will defend itself. America will retaliate.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. Apple unveiled the iPhone 11 for $699 with camera upgrade. At the Apple's annual 4 event yesterday, the company revealed details of the forthcoming iPhone 11 lineup. The design of the three new phones in the coming generation of the handset will certainly look familiar, while the most substantial upgrades include a new rear camera array. First up, iPhone 11. Among other things, Apple is promising 1 hour more in battery life for the iPhone 11 compared to the iPhone XR. The $699 price tag makes the phone $50 cheaper than the XR. And iPhone 11 also sports a 6.1-inch display, along with what Apple says will be faster Face ID with a new A13 Bionic chip. It also includes a dual-camera setup on the back that features upgraded sensors. About the iPhone 11's camera setup, the phone introduces its dual-camera system with new ultra-wide and wide cameras that are integrated into iOS 13, both of those supporting 4K video with extended dynamic range. You'll also be able to shoot detailed action videos with the ultra-wide camera with its wide field of view and large focal plane. The phone updated True Depth camera also introduces a new 12-megapixel camera with a wider field of view to capture more details in, well, when you want to do selfies. Pre-orders for the iPhone 11 starts this Friday at 5 a.m. Pacific time, and the phones will start shipping on September the 20th. iPhone 11 will be available in 64 gigabytes, 128 gigabytes, and 256 gigabyte models, and the colors available are purple, green, yellow, black, white, and red. So what was not announced was any 5G capability built into the iPhone 11. Well, maybe that's an announcement for next year. If you're a New Yorker and you've been on a delayed 4, 5, or 6 subway train recently, you can probably blame Apple's AirPods for your recent transit woes. According to the Wall Street Journal, New York City commuters have lost so many AirPods over the summer that the Metropolitan Transport Authority, that's the MTA, is considering recording a new public service announcement aimed directly at AirPod owners. the potential PSA would ask commuters to refrain from taking their AirPods on and off when entering or exiting a train. The hope is that the PSA will reduce the number of times the MTA is forced to delay a train while its staff rescues one or more of the in-ear headphones. According to the MTA maintenance supervisor, AirPod-related rescues spiked in March when Apple released the second-generation AirPods, and they've only become a more frequent occurrence over the summer with the hot and humid weather. On one Thursday this past August, for instance, his team got 18 requests to retrieve lost items before noon. Of those 18 items, 6 were AirPods. "It's job security as far as we're concerned," he quipped. Coincidentally, all those lost AirPods don't hurt Apple's bottom line either. In the United States, the company charges $69 for a replacement AirPod. If you lose the pair, it's $138. Apple could easily solve a lot of headaches for both owners and transit authorities by redesigning its Bluetooth headphones to make them more customizable. Unlike almost every other pair of Air headphones, wireless or otherwise, AirPods don't allow its owner to adjust the fit of the headphones with different size in-ear buds and wingtips. Of course, it's hard to see the company moving away from a one-size-fits-all approach anytime soon. Until then, we could see other subway system delays because of AirPod-related issues. As expected, Google rolled out Android 10 for all Pixel devices. What happened to all those dessert letters that they were using? Now we're on 10. The release date wasn't shared ahead of time, but Canadian mobile carrier Rogers let the secret slip by including the date in its public schedule of OS updates. The schedule listed the Pixel, Pixel 2, Pixel 3, and Pixel 3a as well as their XL counterparts. Every phone was set to receive Android Q, which since has been renamed Android 10, on September the 3rd. Google's own smartphones are always the first to receive new versions of the Android mobile operating system. So if you own a Pixel, you can start downloading Android 10 right now. Everyone else will have to wait, though, and there have been hints that OnePlus 7 Pro will update to Android 10 as well very quickly. One of the major storylines surrounding Android 10 is actually its name. For the first time in years, Google isn't giving the latest version of Android a clever dessert theme handle. While the team is still using names of suites internally during the development process, the public releases will now simply carry a number. I guess they couldn't find a dessert that starts with a Q. As a major number release, Android 10 is packed with new features. Significant changes, of course, bug fixes, and more, but there are a few additions that stand out. One is a new official dark theme, which is the system-wide dark mode that Android fans have been requesting for years. Google is also giving you more control over your privacy, as Android 10 includes the ability to decide when you want an app to access your location. Android 10 is also a step into the future, as it is built for 5G networks and foldable devices. As more flagship phones launch with 5G capabilities and flexible displays, new software will be necessary to support these standards. Android 10 will be the building block upon which much of this software is built. A former Google insider claiming the company created algorithms to hide its political bias within artificial intelligence platforms, in effect targeting particular words, phrases, and contexts to promote, alter, reference, or manipulate perceptions of internet content. The former Google insider delivered roughly 950 pages of documents to the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. The insider, who has already spoken to the nonprofit organization Project Veritas, met with Sarah Carter on several occasions, and he was interviewed in silhouette to conceal his identity in Group's latest film, which they say exposes bias inside social media platform. The insider mailed a laptop to the Department of Justice containing the same information delivered. The former insider is choosing to remain anonymous until Project Veritas reveals his identity. He told the reporter that on a recent trip to Washington, D.C., that the documents he turned over to the Justice Department will provide proof that Google has been manipulating the algorithms and the evidence of how it was done. Google CEO Pinchet told the House Judiciary Committee in December of last year that the search engine was not biased against conservatives. Pinchet explained what algorithms are said that Google algorithms was not offensive to conservatives because its artificial intelligence does not operate in that manner. He told lawmakers things like relevance, freshness, popularity, and how other people are using it are what drives the search results. Pinchet said that even if his programmers were anti-Republicans, the process is so intricate that the artificial intelligence could not be manipulated, and it was too complicated to train the algorithm to fit their bias. Google did not immediately respond for comments on the insider's claims. However, there will be updates to this. The insider says Google is aware most people are unaware or not knowledgeable about these advanced IT systems and therefore unable to determine who is telling the truth. He said that he honestly thinks that free market can fix this issue. He told a reporter at a meeting in Washington, D.C., that the issue is that the free market has been distorted, and what's happened is that distortion is so grotesque and engineering is so repulsive, all we need to do is just expose what's going on. People can hear that it is bad, but it can be biased. But when you see that Google is actually written with the documents, this will actually be taught in universities of what totalitarian states can do with this type of capability. It will be so revolting that it doesn't matter what the solution is. A solution will just form as a reaction to this manipulation that they have done. He said that he asked himself many times if he's overreacting, and every time he simply looks back at the documents and realizes that he's not. It's that bad, he said. Disclosing Google's own words to the American public is something I must do, and if I am to consider myself a good person, the world that Google is building is not a place I or your children want to live in. The Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. What is Google's motto? Google's motto is apparently, don't be evil. It means, according to them, you want to offer free tools for everyone. You probably thought do not evil meant do not create algorithms to hide the political bias within artificial intelligence platforms. Well, is it really bias? It's up to the Justice Department to determine that with the information they do receive. Uncle Sam is padding the Treasury with millions of dollars to assess bots at the same time that corporations invest more in advanced technology and labor-saving machinery. New robot taxes are expected to multiply in the coming decades as millions of Americans see their jobs automated away. Yes, governments already tax robots because they tax virtually everything that goes into developing and making robots. In a few cases, there are subsidies such as government grants for robot development, but that still means they are taxing you and me to provide the subsidies. Taxing robots, a proposal first suggested by Microsoft founder Bill Gates in 2017 as a way for government to tame the rise of machines and to finance new programs like elder care and education, is back on the front burner. A robot that replaces a factory worker who produces, say, $50,000 of work annually should be taxed at the same level to offset losses in income and Social Security taxes, Bill Gates calculates. For many, it's a total pain in the butt. Anytime employers hear this talk, they cringe because they feel they're already paying enough in taxes. Lawmakers such as former San Francisco City Supervisor Jane Kim have jumped on the bot tax bandwagon as new reports propose novel ways to reduce gaping budget deficits. The latest rise of workplace machines and artificial intelligence has planners worried. One study by Oxford Economics predicts 8.5% of the global workforce will be automated out of work within 10 years. A recent study by the Center for the Urban Future in New York City estimated that the city's 4.4 million jobs had an automation potential of 39%, including over 450,000 highly automatable jobs. Over 1.2 million jobs statewide could be mostly replaced by technology available today. A more automated economy could pose serious challenges to some of New York's most vulnerable workers, and policymakers should be talking about this. Should they? I don't think so. We have enough taxes. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak is wildly outspoken, and he's never been shy to criticize the company he helped build. He told Bloomberg News that Apple should have been split up a long time ago. But he's not talking about government regulators stepping in the way Elizabeth Warren wants. Rather, he's talking about letting Apple spread its divisions across the country and giving them the independence to work on their own ideas rather than concentrating them in centralized castle-like campuses. Steve Wozniak said the following, "I wish Apple on its own had split off a long time ago and spun off independent divisions to faraway places and let them work independently like Hewlett-Packard did when I was there. Apple seems to be doing pretty well as a monolithic entity today. You might note that HP was a company that turned down Wozniak when he wanted to make a personal computer. 5 times, according to Woz. And that HP as a company isn't anywhere near the wildly successful juggernaut that Apple is today." But Woz has also praised HP in the past for letting him work freely. Engineers could go in at night and have access to all parts they needed and tools to work on their own designs. Steve Wozniak also said that he would have preferred Apple to relocate divisions off to other locations as HP did when he worked there. HP had divisions all over the country that acted more independently than in a single campus, and he saw the effects of living in nice environments like Colorado and having more independence as a group to come up with great products. In the case of Apple and the iPhone division to another, etc., he also pointed out for decades that he was the only Apple executive that expressed these sentiments. The campus castle idea is more popular, however. In general, though, Woz does seem to believe something should be done about big tech companies. And here's the part that I have a little problem understanding him. He says, "I think big tech has gotten too big, it's too powerful a force in our life," which I agree with, "and it's taken our choices away. It's hard to escape," Woz told Bloomberg News. But added that he thinks Apple is the best of the companies because it's mostly making money selling products rather than tracking people. He thinks that when it comes to Facebook and Google, competition should be enforced, but in the meantime, give me a choice to pay for almost no tracking. Wait a minute, that's almost like me paying for no one to bother me, paying someone to not harass me. I think there's a term for that. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his segment on product duty cycles and meantime between failure.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I want to get down to business. This is where I give you some little bits of experience from my years of being an IT professional. And one of the things that I have had to deal with is specifying different computers. And one of the things that I deal with in amongst the entire technology range when I'm speccing computers is I look at different things like life cycles and duty cycles and maximum volumes and mean time between failures. And I'm going to try and unpack this whole concept here over the course of the next few minutes. One of the areas that's really big with this is with hard drives. We have a couple of different things we talk about in the hard drive realm. The best way to equate this all is the mean time between failure. We look at how long do hard drives last, and there have been a number of different studies. One study that was very interesting was that that in the first roughly year and a half, 5% of hard drives fail. However, for the next year and a half to 2 years, there's only a 1.4% annual failure rate. But then after that, all of a sudden, numbers start climbing. We start getting up into the 10 to 12% mark at about 4 years. That's right. So we break this on down. So these are different hard drives that are running. And during the first year, we encounter a number of different things. One, the idea of a bad batch of hardware. You go on out, you buy a computer, it has a hard drive in it, and yes, there are some bad hard drives that are going to come out of that, just period. It's all part of manufacturing. Nobody is perfect with manufacturing, and we will wind up getting some lemons. What do they do in that first year? They just swap out the hard drive. Not a big deal to them. They're already aware of the issue, and by the time you get to it, yeah, they'll get you a new hard drive. Now, the next thing is, okay, we have that nice, reliable area, and then all of a sudden it starts to drop off. Why does it drop off? It's no longer about about those initial failures. It's that meantime between failures. It's that whole issue of it's an older hard drive. Cars these days generally have a mean time between failure. We have a certain lifespan that we expect our cars to go through. And depending on what kind of car you drive, you may say, yes, I've got my car in. I expect I'll get about 150,000 miles out of it, or 200,000 miles, or 250,000 miles, or, oh, yeah, it's a big Ford F-150 pickup, and they've got reliability. I'll get 400,000 miles. But you won't. That's because there's mean time between failures. You might get 399,000 miles out of that. You might get 401,000 miles out of it. And it might be some clunker that you got 400,000 miles out of it, even though you expected it would only last 125,000 miles. And it all just boils down to some things are going to last longer than others. Now, that's over in the hard drive realm. Now let's talk about some of the other items that still crop up in this same realm of duty cycles and mean time between failures over in the printer world, because the numbers don't translate the same way. You can buy a brand new printer and you go on out and you say, oh yeah, look at this. It says right here, I can print 30,000 pages every month with this. No, that's a maximum that you should ever print out of that printer in a month. In reality, that's not a reasonable expectation of that printer. You do that, your printer is going to die very quickly. Instead, you look for something. The general rule of thumb these days is you look for, if you are printing 30,000 pages a month, you need a printer that is capable of a maximum of 300,000 pages per month. I know that sounds crazy, but that's just the way this works. That's just how much in a really rough month, and it's really based on you having really strong, heavy-duty days and a lot of really light days. There are going to be days where somebody's going to go on up to the printer and they're going to say, I want to print the entire Wikipedia. It used to be the Encyclopedia Britannica. You get the idea. I want to print the entire, all of the pages on Wikipedia. And it just prints and prints and prints and prints and prints. And other days, yeah, I'm bored. I'm not going to print anything. Oh, I might print off one invoice for one of our clients. So we get that kind of averages. We get those different numbers put together. The best thing over in the printer world is this. Again, we look for something that is about, it's basically 10, if we're printing 1,000 pages, we want something that's 10 times that in a monthly span, 10,000, okay? At the same time, you also need to apply how often are you going to be replacing the toner. You also need to look at, you know, the size of the toner on that. So if you're replacing the toner every 3 weeks, okay, you're going to be paying a lot in the way of toner. Instead, you want to ideally work on a printer that is going to allow you to replace the toner roughly every 2 to 3 months and no more often than that. Yes, that might mean you're going to buy a more expensive printer. That might mean you're going to buy in the hard drive realm. You want something that's going to be in the servers. It's going to have to last a lot longer. You're going to look for something that's a much higher mean time between failure. So there's kind of a glimpse at duty cycles and the like. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
In computing early years, the only languages were machine and assembler. In those days, computing science really was science. Clearly, there needed to be an easier language for programming those big early mainframes. That language, named in September 1959, became Common Business-Oriented Language, COBOL, C-O-B-O-L. It was developed by the Conference on Data Systems Languages, CODASIL. It was one of the first high-level programming languages created. COBOL is run on the mainframe as well as on the PC. COBOL is a compiled English-like computer programming language designed for business use. It is imperative, procedural, and since 2002, object-oriented. COBOL is primarily used in business, finance, and administrative systems for companies and governments. COBOL is still widely used in legacy applications deployed on mainframe computers, such as large-scale batch and transaction processing jobs. Most programming in COBOL is now purely to maintain existing applications. COBOL's basic syntax was nailed down in 1959, and COBOL programs were running by the summer of 1960. In December 1960, COBOL programs proved to be truly interoperable by running on computers from two different vendors. Those two vendors were UNIVAC and RCA. COBOL was on its way to become the first truly commercial programming language. It would still be the business language of choice until well into the 1980s, and it's not done yet. In 2016, the Government Accountability Office, that's the GAO, reported that the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Social Security Administration, to just name three, were still using COBOL. According to a COBOL consulting company, which goes by the delightful name COBOL Cowboys, 200 billion lines of COBOL code are still in use today, and that's 90% of Fortune 500 companies still having COBOL code, keeping the lights on. And if you received cash out of an ATM recently, it's almost certainly COBOL was running behind the scenes. Today, COBOL is kept up and running by Micro Focus. Even though the language is 60 years old, there are many other popular and sleek programming options out there. COBOL is still an important part of our tech-driven world. COBOL still accounts for more than 70% of the business transactions that take place in the world today. Researchers at Lero, that's L-E-R-O, a software engineering research center, claim that there are more than 200 times more COBOL transactions, you get that? 200 times more COBOL transactions than Google searches worldwide. The reason that COBOL has not only stayed around with fellow legacy tech, but remain a juggernaut, is that a large number of companies use systems that incorporate COBOL, and those systems are crucial to operations. The reality is that there's a lot of old software out there which is still at the heart of many critical applications, particularly in the area of financial transactions. This is actually good news for COBOL programmers because they will continue to be in high demand even if companies start upgrading their legacy software and systems overnight. A survey of more than 350 IT professionals found that nearly half of the respondents have already noticed a shortage of COBOL programmers. This shortage can be attributed to COBOL programmers aging out of the industry. 50% of the respondents to the same Computer World survey claimed that their COBOL staff were 45 years of age or older, and half of those respondents cited their COBOL staff as older than 55 years of age. Today, COBOL is everywhere, yet is largely unheard of among millions of people who interact with it on a daily basis. Its reach is so pervasive that it is almost unthinkable that the average person can go a day without it, whether using an ATM, stopping at traffic lights, or purchasing a product online. The vast majority of us will use COBOL in one form or another as part of our daily existence. Despite these facts, newer languages appear to be the popular choice as they frequently catch the eye of the younger generation developer. The world's applications do need different languages, but certain languages are better at certain tasks than others. For instance, COBOL's strength lies in processing financial-style data and number crunching. Java and C# are used more effectively in the front-end user experience. Languages must be for fit for purpose. The problem to solve should determine the language to use. So why do organizations choose to keep COBOL instead of rewriting applications using the latest language? After all, keeping up to date with the latest technology is important in IT. But when other factors are taken into account, the length of downtime during transition from old to new, the fall in return on investment it triggers, the amount of resources it uses, the training involved, and the thought of a rip and replace loses its appeal. As many as 75% of all rewrite projects have resulted in failure. Businesses which already have COBOL staffs in their systems are unlikely to wake up one day and replace it with Java. Newer languages have not had the chance to stand the test of time, so no one knows how robust they will be several years down the line. That risk could cost an organization the business. So for many, COBOL is here to stay. There is a pending problem. The significant concern is that those skilled COBOL programmers are disappearing without being replaced, forming a widening skills gap. Development teams also often work in siloed environments, broken down by programming language or the tools they use, which can inhibit application development. But there are many positive reasons to learn COBOL. The next generation of developers must pick up COBOL skills and carry them forward into the future. COBOL is robust. It's been adapting to business change for decades, so it really knows the ropes when it comes to keeping things running. Throughout its life so far, it has come across many different obstacles, such as new platforms and devices, and it has met each of these challenges. It even integrates with the next generation of modern languages, such as C#, Java, and VirtualBasic.net. COBOL is intuitive. It's easy to learn because of English-like structural components, and it's been ported to virtually every hardware platform. It runs with modern languages, so there's no need to worry about learning a new tool set. COBOL is the perfect language to broaden the coding experience, and it's a language skills desired by employers. It's only a matter of time until COBOL will regain a spotlight as one of the most in-demand skills of future generation of software engineers. We can just see it now, out of their driverless cars, walk into their offices, and sit down to start coding in 1959's COBOL. Yeah, I know, it sounds crazy. Considering COBOL is the furthest thing from most engineers' minds today, it ranks fairly low in today's measurement of most popular programming languages. Many newer, speedier languages give today's coders little reason not to scoff at the antiquated COBOL. The most telling evidence of COBOL's irrelevancy is that about 70% of universities said they don't even include COBOL in their computer science curriculum anymore, according to a recent survey. It's logical. Why waste curriculum space for a skill that employers don't even look for these days? A quick search for a COBOL program on any job site, for instance, yields a few hundred postings, while the more popular Java programmer yields thousands. As demand grows for more agile and innovative systems, it's difficult to reconcile technology in its seventh decade with the technology we carry around in our pockets or use at home. While dissenters continue to challenge the validity of the mainframe, the technology keeps on proving its worth. Anytime you call a call center, anytime you transfer money, or check your account, or pay a mortgage, or renew or get an insurance quote, or when contacting a government department, or shipping a parcel, or ordering some flowers, or buying something online at a whole range of retailers, or booking a vacation, or a flight, or trading stocks, or even checking your favorite baseball seasonal statistics, you're interacting with COBOL. That's because the largest number of businesses use COBOL are financial institutions. This includes banking, insurance, and wealth management equities trading, and second is government services, federal, provincial, and local. So while COBOL is nearing retirement age, the language itself is still far from being put out to pasture. In fact, some people are moving their COBOL application to the cloud. At this rate, COBOL programs will outlive us all.
So what are some of the new things in Android 10 that you couldn't do before? It's here. Android 10, once known as Android Q, is finding its way to Pixel phones, with other handsets getting the update when manufacturers get around to it. When you get Android 10 on your device, these are the new features and goodies that you can start playing around with. Do more with Smart Replies. Smart Replies are getting an upgrade in Android 10. You've previously been able to use them to pick a preset message, but now they'll recognize Google Map links, YouTube videos, and other URLs embedded in messages and let you jump to the relevant app right from the notification pop-up. The same smart functionality is coming to all your favorite messaging apps. Another feature is turning on dark theme. Dark themes and dark mode seem to be having a moment. Whether people are just up for a change, really, to do what to ease the strain on their eyes, or need their apps to reflect the troubling times in which we live. Android 10 now has a system-wide dark theme that you can enable. From the setting app, pick display, then dark theme, to add it to the quick settings panel. Drag the panel over, then tap on the pencil icon on the bottom left. Live caption your videos. One of the more impressive features rolling out with Android 10 is Live Caption, which puts captions on top of videos in real time, whether that's a YouTube video on the web or a clip that you've just shot yourself. It works offline too, apparently. The feature isn't actually enabled yet, so it can't be tested yet outright, but it's going to be available this fall. You can also take more control over location sharing. You can now take more granular control over how apps can access your device's location, or the time only when the app is open or never, the same way iOS handles it. You'll also get periodic reminders about apps that are accessing your location in the background, just like iOS. If you want to change the setting for an app that's already installed, go to Settings, Apps and Notifications, pick an app, and then choose Permissions and Location. A new feature will be to enable the new Focus Mode. The digital well-being app that runs on top of Android 9 and Android 10 is getting an extra Focus Mode, which you can find by going into Settings and tapping Digital Well-being and Parental Controls, then Focus Mode. It essentially lets you pause alerts from selected apps when you don't want to be interrupted. On the Focus Mode screen, you can choose the apps to temporarily mute as well as add a Focus Mode shortcut to quick settings. There are changes to gesture navigation. Switching over from iPhones to Android phones is going to be a lot easier now. Google is banishing buttons and going all in on gestures. To change the input method your phone uses and to get a refresher on some of the basics, open up Settings, then choose System, Gestures, and System Navigation. Another new feature is you can manage your privacy more easily. Android 10 brings your phone privacy settings more into line what you can access through your Google account page on the web. If you go to Settings, then tap Privacy and Advanced, you will see that you can access an Activity Controls option. As on the web, this lets you choose how Google tracks you, and if you dig deeper into the options, you can enable the new-ish auto-delete feature that erases your digital tracks after 3 or 18 months. If you want to amplify sounds and media, Google lists Sound Amplifier as a feature of Android 10, even though it's available as a separate download for devices running Android 6 and above, and presumably it's now built into Android for the first time with Android 10. The add-on, which pops up on the accessibility menu in Settings, lets you reduce distracting background noise and boost important sounds from around you using any pair of wired headphones. Google is funneling more key security updates through Google Play rather than Android itself, starting with Android 10. That means your device should stay protected against the most dangerous threats, even if the manufacturer isn't making the actual Android upgrade much of a priority. These updates will mostly happen in the background, apparently with new patches auto-installing the way that Android apps do. Android 10 introduces yet another way to deal with notification overload, the silent notification. Apps delivering silent alerts won't vibrate your device or make a sound, and these notifications won't wake up the screen or appear as pop-ups over other apps. But you will still be able to see these updates in the silent notifications part of the notification list. To change the settings for an app, swipe left or right on one of its alerts and tap on the cog icon, or go to Apps and Notifications in Settings and choose the app. Although many of us don't have it, there will be a Use Foldable Devices. We've already seen a handful of foldable devices hit the market running Android, but with Android 10, the folding form factor is officially supported. In other words, apps won't suddenly freak out when the screen doubles in size. This is more of a future-proofing feature than anything else, as is the official introduction of support for 5G connections. So when the next-gen infrastructure starts rolling out, Android will be ready. You want to get a friend, family member, or work colleague on the Wi-Fi at home or in the office? It's easier in Android 10. From Network and Internet and Wi-Fi, in Settings, tap on the network that you're currently connected to. You see a Share button that, when pressed, displays a QR code. The other party can scan that with your Android 10 device camera to get connected. For good measure, the Wi-Fi password is listed underneath the QR code. See when your battery will run out. Swipe down from the top of the screen on your Android 10 device, and you'll see that the Wi-Fi cell reception and battery level icons have been redesigned to give you a better visual clue to the levels in each case. Not only that, but you'll see an estimate of how long your battery will last right in the status bar. It's a bit more useful than a simple percentage reading, but it's only a guess based on how intensively you've used your phone. Google will scrub through audio from notification pop-ups. They won't call out all little tweaks and customizations scattered throughout the Android 10 interface. There's a lot of them, but this is one change you might actually make use of: a scrubbing bar on the persistent notification for audio player apps. That means you can skip forward or backwards in a song, podcast, or anything else without having to open the app. Note that the lock screen background changes based on what's being played too. Share more easily. The Share panel has been revamped in Android 10, and in addition to opening up more quickly thanks to some under-the-hood engineering tweaks, it's also more intelligently arranged to promote the people and the apps you share to most often. You'll also be able to see what you're actually sharing up at the top of the dialog. So if it's an image, Android 10 will display a small thumbnail of it alongside various sharing options. With Android 10 interface, you can tweak. Now you will be able to tweak the Android 10 interface. Android 10 doesn't quite support full-on theming, but it offers a few theming-related tweaks. If you enable Developer Options, go to System, Advanced, then Developer Options and Setting, then go right down to the theming section. You can change the accent color used across Android, as well as the font used for headline and body text, and the default shape of icon shown on the screen. And finally, quite important, is change battery saver setting. You're also getting more control over the battery saver settings. Android has included a low battery mode for years, but now you got more of a choice about when it kicks in and starts limiting the power draw of your apps. From Settings, go to Battery, then Battery Saver, and if you tap Set a Schedule, you can enable the mode at a certain time or when the battery hits a certain point. I can't wait now for Android 10 to be available on my Moto cell phone. Presenting Marty Winston on home automation for Cheapskates. What's the most expensive home automation product you've ever seen? What does it really do? Does it just expand the vocabulary of your Alexa or your Google Assistant? Is it just an overpriced way to make some little thing happen? Hey Marty, give us your perspective on how we should look at home automation.
Hey, are you buying into the home automation craze? If you have a really, really good reason to be able to turn your lights on or off when you're in Zanzibar, hey, there's an app for you to control the hardware to make that happen. The app usually comes free to support the hardware you pay for. Of course, your cellular data plan may make a Zanzibar connection a little pricey. Maybe you'd rather spend your money on something more life-critical. Or maybe you'd rather save it. That doesn't make you a cheapskate. But, you know, a cheapskate is a good role model to don when it's time to think about spending money on home automation products. A cheapskate carefully considers buying anything. Do you just want it? Or do you really need it? What does it do that's so very different from how you do that thing now? And what's wrong with the way you do that thing now? Are you buying home automation just to show it off? Show it off to your friends, your neighbors, or family? Or is there some special thing that has true importance to you? And if you've lived without it this long, why can't you live without it now? There are ways to do what you want to do without using the usual home automation products, and I'll get there in a minute. But first, let me give you a compelling reason to avoid home automation products. It's the cloud. Have you ever seen the cloud? It's not as glamorous as it sounds. It just means, and I'll be specific, it means a server that's at somebody else's address, a server over which you have no control, and a server that is, in order to be a cloud, connected to the internet. I know you've heard of the internet. It's the road that Russian hackers take to work every day. Automation overall gets glamorized as the Internet of Things. Whoa! Well, a very senior writer, David English, restates that in a meaningful way, and I quote him every chance I get. He calls it the Internet of Hackable Things. Let me share one of my favorite examples. It's about a guy who bought a smart thermostat. A Russian hacker took over total control of it and made his home very uncomfortable, almost unlivable, sent the guy a Bitcoin ransom demand, modest as such things go, because he was only asking for, it turned out to be about $90. And the guy paid it. Understand, it would have cost him less than $30 to buy a dumb thermostat to replace the smart one, and the dumb thermostat would not be vulnerable to cyber mischief. If you take no other lesson away with you, please remember this. Home automation makes you vulnerable to Russian hackers. Remember, if Alexa can do it, Alexei can do it. And never mind the vendor's claims of military-grade encryption. Those Russian hackers eat that for breakfast along with their cornflakes. Still interested in home automation? Listen, I get it. The past decade's endless waves of home automation products created an impression, both among consumers and among home builders, that clusters of immodestly priced wares are necessary to accomplish automation goals within a residence. Bull. There are lots of ways to accomplish automation at your house without buying any of those products. They've diverted your attention from a significant reality. We've had products that help automate our lives for many, many decades. Stop thinking of what kind of home automation gizmo you want to buy, and start thinking of what it is that you really need it to do. It's amazing how many times a $60 to $99 or $150 connected gizmo is doing the job of something you can get for $12 or $15 or $20. Lighting, great example. There are scores of nightlights that detect both ambient light levels and motion, and they only turn on when it's dark and there's somebody there. Then they stay on for just a few moments longer once everybody's gone. One piece, no batteries, plugs in the wall, no Z-Wave, no Bluetooth, no Zigbee, no Wi-Fi. They just work. Do you want home automation to make your house look lived in when you're away? There are light switches with built-in timers that know not only the time of day, but what times dusk and dawn happen. Or you can get the same functionality in a standalone timer that, you know, it plugs into the wall and your thing plugs in it. Your lamp plugs into its receptacle. And you can handle multiple on and off times with different cycles and different models of those very affordable timers. Speaking of light switches, you can also get those with motion sensing built in. So lights come on when you're there, turn off when you're not. And speaking of electrical switches, there are specialty switches available that get installed into door jams. Very handy, for lighting up closets or pantries whenever their doors are open. I think it may be a trick they learned from refrigerators. And in terms of just plain switching lights on and off from your smartphone, give me a break. Just get up off your keister and flick the switch. The movement will probably do you some good. And as for packages left at the door, there are bolt-down metal boxes with one-way doors that make more sense than video doorbells. Do you really think there are bad guys anywhere who don't recognize that if the voice at the door comes through a speaker, there's really nobody home? I'd probably add a much brighter light at the door, triggered whenever anybody is there between dusk and dawn. Besides saving you a lot of money, these old-school solutions can also save you a lot of hassles. These products don't need to communicate through Zigbee or Z-Wave or wireless hubs, don't have the range limitations of Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, don't make you get a handset app just to set them up, don't raise compatibility issues with other devices, and don't leave you with your pants down when it comes to cyber mischief and ransomware. That's home automation for cheapskates, and you don't have to be a cheapskate for it to make sense for you. Next time, you may want to take notes because I'll be talking about winterizing your personal tech. But no, I don't know anywhere to get pumpkin spice batteries.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open and free to the public. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is iOS iPhone versus Android phones, Goliath versus Goliath, at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, room 408 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have their 40th anniversary on September the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and the topic of presentation is the sunset of Windows 7. They meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on likes, tweets, and regrams, an overview of social media. Tuesday, October the 1st, meeting time is 2 p.m. in the afternoon at the Ewing Senior and Community Center at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on online privacy Thursday, October the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, October the 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting that you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for me, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.